The Principles of the Most Ancient and Modern Philosophy by Anne Finch, Viscountess Conway, first published in 1690. This reading is based on a text at the website www.earlymoderntexts.com. Reader, Mill Nicholson. Chapters 1 through 3. Chapter 1. God and His Divine Attributes. God is spirit, light, and life. He is infinitely wise, good, just, and strong. He knows everything, is present everywhere, can do anything. He is the creator and maker of all things visible and invisible. Time doesn't pass in God, nor does any change occur. He doesn't have parts arranged thus and so, giving him a certain constitution. Indeed, he doesn't have separate parts. He is intrinsically, self-containedly one, a being with no variation and with nothing mixed into it. There are in God no dark parts, no hints of anything to do with bodies, and therefore nothing, nothing in the way of form or image or shape. God is an essence or substance that is in the correct literal sense distinct from his creatures. He is one substance, and they are others, but he is not separated or cut off from them. On the contrary, he is closely and intimately and intensely present in everything. Yet his creatures are not parts of him, and they can't change into him, any more than he can change into them. He is also, in the correct literal sense, the creator of all things, who doesn't just shape them up in a certain way, but gives them their essence, their life, their body, and anything else they have that is good. And because in God there is no time and therefore no change, God can't ever have new knowledge or make a new decision. His knowledge and his will, i.e. his decisions, choices, wants, are eternal, outside time or beyond time. Similarly, God has none of the passions that his creatures produce, because every passion is temporal. It starts at a time and ends at a time. In God there is an idea that is his image, i.e. the Word that exists in him. In its substance or essence, this idea or Word is identical with God himself. It is through this idea or Word that God knows himself as well as everything else. All creatures were made or created according to it. Similarly, there is spirit or will in God that comes from him and yet is one with him, in its substance or essence. It is through this will that creatures receive their essence and activity. Creatures have their essence and existence purely from him, because God, whose will agrees with his utterly infinite knowledge, wants them to exist as the fundamental kinds of things they are, and as having the detailed histories that they do. And thus God's wisdom and will are not entities or substances distinct from him, but distinct modes or properties of a single substance. And this one substance is the very thing that the most knowledgeable and judicious Christians are referring to when they speak of the Trinity. The standard account of the Trinity says that there are three persons in one substance, but the phrase three distinct persons is a stumbling block and offence to Jews, Moslems, and other people, is actually without any reasonable sense, and doesn't occur anywhere in Scripture. If that phrase were omitted from the doctrine of the Trinity, what was left would be readily accepted by everyone. For Jews and Moslems and the rest hardly deny that God has wisdom, and has within himself a Word by which he knows everything. And when they concede that this same being gives all things their essences, they have to accept that he has a will through which something that was hidden in the idea of him is brought to light and made actual, created and maintained, when God creates and fashions a distinct and essential substance. This is to create the essence of a creature. A creature doesn't get its existence from the idea alone, but rather from will, and the idea conjointly, just as an architect's idea of a house doesn't build the house unaided, i.e. without the cooperation of the architect's will. Chapter 2. Creatures and Time. All creatures are, or exist, simply because God wants them to. His will is infinitely powerful, and his mere command can give existence to creatures without having any help, without using any means to the end of creation, and without having any material to work on. Hence, since God's will exists and acts from eternity, it follows necessarily that creation results immediately, with no time lapse, from the will to create. But don't think that creatures are themselves co-eternal with God. If you do, you'll muddle together time and eternity. Still, an act of God's creative will is so immediately followed by the start of the creature's existence that nothing can intervene, like two circles that immediately touch each other in a geometrical diagram. And don't credit creatures with having any other source but God himself and his eternal will. The will that follows the guidance of his eternal idea is eternal wisdom. It naturally follows from this that the time past since the moment of creation is infinite. It doesn't consist of any number of minutes, hours, or years, or any number that a created intellect can conceive, for how could it be marked off or measured when it has no other beginning than eternity itself? If you want to insist that time is finite, you are committed to time's having begun some definite number of years back, perhaps, as some people think, 6,000 years ago, or, as others allow, 600,000 years ago. Or let it be any finite distance into the past, perhaps inconceivably far back, but still at a definite starting point, T. Now tell me, could the world have been created earlier than it was? Could the world, and therefore time, have existed before T? If you say no, then you are restricting the power of God to a certain number of years. If you say yes, then you are allowing for time before all times, which is a plain contradiction. On this basis, we can easily answer a question that has greatly worried many people. Did creation occur? Could it have occurred from eternity? There are two answers to this, corresponding to two ways of understanding from eternity. Taking the question to be asking, has the created world existed for an infinite number of times? The answer is yes. But if the question is asking, is the created world eternal in the way that God is eternal, meaning that it didn't ever have a beginning? The answer is no. There's nothing surprising in the view that times, the totality of them, taken all together, are infinite. It is, after all, conceivable that even the smallest stretch of time has something infinite about it. Just as no time is so long that a still longer one can't be conceived, so also no time is so short that even shorter time can't be imagined. The infinity of time from the beginning of creation can likewise be proved by the goodness of God. For God is infinitely good, loving, and generous. Indeed, he is goodness and charity, the infinite fountain and ocean of goodness, charity, and generosity. How could that fountain not flow perpetually? Won't that ocean perpetually overflow for the production of creatures and be continuously in flood for their benefit? God's goodness communicates itself and makes itself grow. That is its nature. It can't be amplified by anything outside God, anything making up for some lack in him, because there isn't anything that he lacks. He is too absolutely complete for that. And since he can't augment himself, because that would be the creating of many gods, which is a contradiction, it necessarily follows that he brought creatures into existence from time everlasting, i.e. through a numberless sequence of periods. Otherwise, the goodness communicated by God, which is his essential attribute, would indeed be finite, and could be numbered in terms of years. Nothing is more absurd. So God's essential attribute is to be a creator. God always was a creator, therefore, and he always will be one, because otherwise he would change, and they always have been creatures, and they always will be. The eternity of creatures is nothing but the infinity of times in which they have existed and always will exist. This infinity of times is not the same as God's infinite eternity, because there's nothing temporal about the divine eternity. Nothing in it can be called past or future. It is always entirely present. God is in time, but he isn't contained in it. Why is the infinity of time different from God's eternity? The answer is obvious. On the one hand, time is nothing but the successive motion or operation of creatures. If they stopped moving or operating, time would come to an end, and the creatures would go out of existence, because it is the essential nature of every creature to move in its progression towards greater perfection. Whereas, on the other hand, in God there is no successive motion, no process of growing in perfection, because he is absolutely perfect already. So there are no times in God or in his eternity. And there is another reason too. There are no parts in God, so there are no times in him, because all times have parts and are, as I said earlier, infinitely divisible. Chapter 3. Freedom, Infinity, Space. If we consider the divine attributes that I have mentioned, especially God's wisdom and his goodness, then we can utterly refute, we can destroy, the indifference of the will that has been attributed to God, and wrongly called free will, by the scholastics and by other so-called philosophers. God's will is indeed utterly free. Just because he is free and acts spontaneously in whatever he does, anything he does regarding his creatures is done without any external force or compulsion, and without any causal input from the creatures. But he is not, repeat, not ever indifferent about whether or not to act. If he were, that would be an imperfection, making God like his corruptible creatures. This indifference of will is the basis for all changeability and corruptibility in creatures. I link those two, because if creatures weren't changeable, they couldn't be corrupted. Crediting God with that indifference of will would be implying that he is changeable, and thus is like corruptible man, who often acts from sheer will, with no true and solid reason, i.e., no guidance from wisdom. That likens God to cruel tyrants, who mostly act from their own sheer will, relying on their power, and not being able to give any explanation for their actions except, "I chose to do it." In contrast with that, any good man can give a suitable explanation for what he does or will do, because he understands that true goodness and wisdom require him to have such an explanation. So he wants to act as he does because it is right, and he knows that if he doesn't, he will be neglecting his duty. True justice or goodness, therefore, is not indifferent. There's no slack in it. Rather, it is like a straight line. There can't be two or more equally straight lines between two points. Only one line between them can be straight, and all others must be curved, more or less, depending on how much they depart from the straight line. So it is obvious that this indifference of will, which is an imperfection, has no place in God. For this reason, God is both a most free agent and a most necessary one. Anything that he does in relation to his creatures is something that he must do, because his infinite wisdom, goodness, and justice are for him a law that can't be broken. It clearly follows that God was not indifferent about whether or not to bring creatures into existence, and that he made them from an inner impulse of his divine goodness and wisdom. So he created worlds, i.e., created creatures, as promptly as he could, because it's the nature of a necessary agent to do as much as he can. Since he could have created worlds or creatures from time immemorial, before 6,000, before 60,000, before 600,000 years ago, he has done this. God can do anything that doesn't imply a contradiction. worlds or creatures will exist continuously through an infinite time in the future. There's nothing contradictory about that. So there's no contradiction either in worlds or creatures have existed continuously through an infinite past time. From these divine attributes, properly understood, it follows that God has made an infinity of worlds or creatures. He is infinitely powerful, so there can't be any number n of creatures such that God couldn't create more than n creatures. And as we have seen, he does as much as he can. His will, goodness, and kindness certainly extend as far as his power does. Thus, it clearly follows that he has infinitely many creatures of infinitely many different types, so that they can't be counted or measured, either of which would set a limit to them. Suppose that the universe of creatures is spherical, and is this big. Its radius is n times the diameter of the earth, where n is the number of grains of dust in the entire world. And suppose that its ultimate parts, its atoms, are so small that a single poppy seed contains 100,000 atoms. That yields an immensely large finite number of very small atoms, but it can't be denied that God with his infinite power could make this number greater and greater by multiplying to infinity. And since, as I have said, God is a necessary agent who does everything that he can do, it follows that he did, and always does, multiply and increase the essences of creatures to infinity. The same argument shows that not only the universe, or system of creatures, as a whole is infinite, i.e. has infinity in itself, but every creature has infinity in it. A creature may be the smallest we can see with our eyes, or even the smallest we can conceive of in our minds, but it has in itself an uncountable infinity of parts, or rather of entire creatures. It can't be denied that God can put one creature inside another, so he could just as easily put in two, or four, or eight, endlessly multiplying creatures by always placing smaller creatures inside larger ones. And just as no creature could be so small that there couldn't be a smaller one, so also no creature is so big that an even bigger one isn't always possible. It follows that infinitely many creatures can be contained in any creature, however tiny, and that all these could be bodies and mutually impenetrable. As for created spirits, which can penetrate one another, any one of these can contain infinitely many others, which all have the same extent, the same spatial size, as one another, and as the spirit that contains them. What happens here is that the spirits are more finely divided and more spiritual, which enables them to penetrate items that are less finely divided, more lumpy, more corporeal. So there's no shortage of space to force some of them to give way so as to make room for others. I'll say more about the nature of bodies and spirits in the proper place. All I need here is to demonstrate that in every creature, whether spirit or body, there is an infinity of creatures, each of which contains an infinity in itself. All these things praise and commend God's great power and goodness, the way his infinity appears radiantly in the works of his hands, right down to every single one of his creatures. You might think, this can't be right, because it puts infinity into us, putting us on a par with God. That is wrong, because just as one infinity is greater than another, so God is always infinitely greater than all his creatures. Nothing can be compared to him. Thus, God's truly invisible attributes can be clearly seen by being understood through the things he has made, or in the things he has made. The greater and more magnificent his works, the more they show the Maker's greatness. Some people hold that there's only a finite number of creatures in the universe, so that they are countable, and that the whole body of the universe occupies so many acres or miles or diameters of the earth in length, depth, and breadth. They are estimating God's great majesty according to a petty and undignified scale. They are telling a tale not about God, but about an idol of their own imagination, whom they confined to a narrow space, like the tiny birdcage a few inches wide. Isn't that a fair description of the world they imagine, when it's compared to the true and great universe that I have described? They may say, we don't confine God within this finite universe. We take him to exist within it and also in the infinite spaces that we imagine outside it. But if those imagined spaces are merely imaginary, they're nothing but idle fictions. And if they are real entities, what else can they be but creatures of God? Also, either God is at work in those spaces or he isn't. If he isn't, he isn't there, because God works wherever he is. It's his nature to act, just as it's the nature of fire to burn or of the sun to shine. For God always works, and his work is bringing creatures into existence according to the eternal idea or wisdom that is in him. Moreover, this continual action or operation of God, considered as something that is in him, i.e. comes from him, or considered in relation only to himself, is just one continual action or command of his will. There is nothing serial or temporal in it, no before or after. It is always all present to God. Nothing in it is past or future, because God has no parts. But considered as manifested in creatures, or as operating on creatures, God's action is temporal and has a series of parts. It's hard for us to imagine this, or to grasp it conceptually, but there is a good solid reason for affirming it. Perhaps we can be helped a little in our attempts to grasp it, by thinking of a great wheel rotating around its centre while the centre remains in the same place. The centre moves the whole thing, producing a great and continual motion, yet the centre remains always motionless and isn't moved in any way. How much more true this is of God, who is the first mover of all his creatures, giving them their true and appointed motions. But they don't move him. It is appropriate to use the wheel example in this way, because the rule of God's will is the analogue in him of the motions and operations of creatures. But this is only an analogy. Strictly speaking, there is no motion in God, because all motion is successive. I have maintained that the smallest creatures that can be conceived have infinitely many creatures within themselves, so that the smallest particles of body or matter can be stretched and divided in infinite ways into ever smaller parts. Some people have objected to this, opposing it with atomism, as follows. Whatever is actually divisible as far as any actual division can go, is divisible into indivisible parts. And matter is actually divisible as far as any actual division can go. Therefore, matter is divisible into indivisible parts. This argument suffers from the fallacy that logicians call combining uncombinables, i.e. joining words or terms that jointly imply contradiction or absurdity. This fallacy is lurking in the phrase actually divisible, which says that one and the same thing is, and is not, divided. For actually signifies division, while divisible signifies not division, but the capacity to be divided. Combining these into a single phrase is as absurd and contradictory as seeingly blind or vitally dead. And if the objectors clear themselves of this fallacy by using the phrase actually divisible to mean just one of those two things, i.e. either to refer only to what really has been divided, or to refer to what is merely capable of being divided, a different fallacy will be readily apparent to us. If the objectors use actually divisible to refer only to what has been divided, then I grant them their premise. Whatever has been actually divided, as far as any actual division can go, is divisible into indivisible parts. But in that case, their premise, matter has been actually divided as far as any actual division can go, is false. On the other hand, if they use actually divisible to refer only to whatever is merely divisible, i.e. is capable of being divided, then I deny the premise. Whatever can be divided, as far as any actual division can go, is divisible into indivisible parts. And anyway, the clause from which this starts is a mere tautology, an empty repetition of the same thing. Of course anything can be divided as far as any actual division of it can go. An argument based on it is on a par with whatever can be removed from its place as far as it can be removed only up to a certain distance. London can be removed from its place as far as it can be removed. Therefore, etc. The same form of argument can be used to prove that the human soul exists, or has its essence, for only a finite number of years, so that it is mortal, comes to an end. Anything whose time or duration is actually divisible, to the extent to which an actual division of it can be made, will come to an end, and is divisible into a finite number of years. The soul's time or duration is actually divisible to the extent to which an actual division of it can be made. Therefore, etc. Please note that when I say that the smallest particle of body is always divisible into even smaller parts to infinity, so that there can't be any actual division in matter that couldn't be carried still further, I'm not specifying what God's power will be or is absolutely able to do. Some people do that. Their behaviour is crass and stupid. I am only indicating what God's power does and will do insofar as it operates in creatures and through creatures in all its productive activities. The point being that in all analysis and divisions of bodies, nature never has, i.e. creatures never have, divided any body into parts so small that they couldn't be further divided. And the body of any creature can't ever be reduced to its smallest parts, not through the most fine-grained operations of any creature or created power. And that's enough for my present purpose. For God doesn't make divisions in any body or matter, except by working together with his creatures. Therefore, he never reduces creatures to their smallest parts. That is because it is the nature of all motion that it breaks down and divides something into finer parts. So if a material thing were broken down into its finest parts, no motion could occur in it. Bringing that about would be contrary to God's wisdom and goodness. Any creature in which all motion had ceased would be entirely useless in creation. It would be no better than nothing. And I repeat, for God to be unable to do something would be contrary to God's wisdom, his goodness, and all his other attributes. Everything is infinitely divisible, always divisible into ever smaller parts. This isn't an empty or useless theory. On the contrary, it's extremely useful in understanding the causes and reasons of things, and in understanding that all creatures, from the highest to the lowest, are inseparably united thus. They send out from themselves some of their more finely divided parts. These are mediators. They intervene between one creature and another, enabling them to act on one another at great distances. This is the basis of all the sympathy and antipathy that occurs in creatures. Someone with a good grasp of these things can easily see into the most secret and hidden causes of most things, which ignorant men call occult qualities. End of chapter 3.